This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
8 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're still listening to Power Talk with me, Aldrin Simpia. It's time for Thought Council and three conversations that we normally have. 0619870000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpia, hashtag Power Talk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. So we are joined today by journalism lecturer Sim Chazi, who wants to speak about employment rather, and why he believes that SOEs can't be used to create employment. We're also joined by the chairperson of the National Healthcare Professionals Association, Dr. Donald Gumede, who wants to discuss COVID-19 lessons and especially COVID-19 transmissions, particularly between family members. And we also have postgraduate media scholar and chartered accountant Mandi Sambulo, who wants to discuss social trauma of being a South African, and where do we find constructive outlets for the emotions that we go with. And you know, some of those emotions that we experience, like for instance, like what happened now with the open line and the experience of the two-year-old, and how SAPS failed her, and how the hospital also failed her and her family. And for me, my thing is that, listen, she was there. The two-year-old was there to witness all of this happening. The two-year-old was there to witness all of that happening at the age of two. This feature is brought to you by Saika, the premier accounting institute that develops highly competent accountancy professionals from a functional to a strategic level of financial management.
Aldrin Sampier, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
Molweni, molweni, sanbonani, mandisa, sabona bab kumete, sabona bab chazi.
Good, sabona.
Yeah, but what's that, Aldrin?
No, ngiyaphila. Mandisa, let's start off with you. Let's start off with your conversation, just as a segue from the conversation that we were having during the open line.
Sure. I just heard you mention the traumatic experience of the two-year-old child, and yeah. I think that was actually the incident that caused me to bring this issue up.
Wow.
I remember, I think it was on Wednesday morning, I got into the car and I heard that story, and I remember actually just being in tears behind the steering wheel, because I just think this country, I think the constant barrage of these kinds of stories is the reality of our country. But I'm just starting to think, is there a better way for us to have these conversations? Because I'm thinking of, so let me backtrack a bit. Yesterday, the journalist from Media 24, Cornita Hunter, published an article of hers where she, with the headline, "We are traumatized as a nation and there's no silver lining." And so I took a bit of issue with her headline just because the concept that there is no silver lining. But the article itself, I think, is expressing generally, I think, where we've been as a country probably for the whole 26 years. Just the sense that there is interpersonal trauma we're experiencing, personal traumas we're experiencing, and then it's the trauma of sympathizing or empathizing with the stories we hear. And there's just so much of it happening just constantly. And I wonder I'm wondering about the effect that it has on everybody's mental health. And I know specifically with Juanita, she's taken the issue of the mental health of journalists who report on these stories as well. She's taken that up to say a lot of journalists are actually experiencing depression and because of the beats that they're covering. And so I'm just thinking about the way we're speaking about all of these issues. I'm just getting a sense that it's making us feel, I think, just the emotions that drain our energy. So it's making us feel quite disempowered. And I'm wondering, is there a way for us to have these conversations in a better way? And so I'm thinking about something that Sim would remember this. There's a Highway Africa Journalism Conference that happens at Rhodes every year. And in 2017, one of them took a session where he was talking about basically the power of communication in times of radical change. And he was just basically challenging the people who write the stories that we read to question all the tools that they have at their disposal. And basically the crux of his argument was you need to position the people in your stories as citizens and as people who have rights and responsibilities. Yes. And so basically to give the reader a sense that, you know, there is something, there is agency, there's something I can do about this, because I just worry that, I think Juanita wrote about this as well, even with the stories of corruption and the thing of not seeing any accountability, and we're all, I think, having quite emotional reactions to this. Well, either angry or we're anxious about the state of the country, and there's no way for us to take that energy. And so I'm thinking about...
Sure. I was going to ask Sim to come in here around the bit that you just raised now, in terms of when we speak about journalism as well, and being a journalist myself, Sim, is... I remember when I joined the team here at on Power, and we joined Power Talk, and we used to have conversations about how, for instance, do we approach the unemployment story and so forth. And I remember saying to the team that we should never just approach the unemployment story as just a data story, as just a number story. We need to place we need to have voices to these numbers. We need to have faces to these numbers, and we must make sure that their stories transcend the data that we try to unpack.
Yes, obviously. No, you're absolutely right, Aldrin. And thank you very much for inviting me. I agree with you entirely that stories about unemployment, the same way that we are covering other stories, I mean, to make sure that people understand that they're real faces, they're real families, they're real aunties and uncles and gogos and, you know, children and, you know, that kind of thing behind all these statistics. I think it's important that we also cover them like that for unemployment, because one of the most, I think, traumatizing thing, thinking about, you know, kind of linking it to what Mandis has just said, that, I mean, being unemployed is also a very traumatizing experience, especially if you've had a job before. You know, it's a very traumatizing experience. I mean, think about the machismo. It's not so much machismo as it is in South America, but I think it is also a function of, you know, of this patriarchal society where a man just feels so emasculated when he doesn't have a job. Yes. But it doesn't even matter that he's a man. Even if it's a woman, would also feel traumatized if she has got children at home and she doesn't know how she's going to feed them. And the biggest problem, I think, in South Africa is that she cannot feed her children, and there are some people who are crashing Lamborghinis and Porsches and, you know, and over ill-gotten wealth. I mean, that is the thing, I think, which is so delicate and difficult for us as, you know, South Africans to deal with, because you see a sea of poverty and there are these little islands of beauty and incredible wealth.
Do you think we've become numb to it?
I think we have become numb to it, and part of the reason we have, I think, is that it's a little bit kind of a perfidy, in the sense that people, I think South Africans are not immune to the other problems, the problems which are related to other African countries, where there's a lot of this insidious tribalism, you know, let's say ethnic identification, that if a person who has taken the money from Limpopo is one of us, you know, in a sense, you know, and is showing off his wealth, or your wealth really, you know, it is okay. And that is the real problem, actually, because if these guys were actually sharing that wealth and not buying these incredibly expensive cars and buying houses in every province, maybe it would be a little bit better. But they actually don't, this money doesn't trickle down. It is a lot of this money. I mean, look at these brands they are consuming. These are brands which are, you know, made in Europe and North America. They're not helping us at all, but they are, because they're such status symbols, it is something
Dr. Kumete, tell me about, for instance, in the medical profession, and taking care of patients, and sometimes patients unfortunately lose their lives, you know, after you've tried your level best. Tell us about the process of debriefing and why debriefing is important.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me back to this segment. It's actually, maybe let me just touch base with what my colleagues have just mentioned now. Firstly, especially the traumatic experience of the two-year-old. If you do not attend to their psychological needs, they grow up angry, bitter, disappointed with life, and they end up maybe being addicted to substance abuse and maybe other lives which actually are not maybe in the norms of the society. So actually mental health is very critical. And but then going back a little bit, some of these atrocities that we cause to each other, it's actually things that we should have been corrected as children. So you find that people grow up angry, maybe being homophobic or being racist, and those things are built from an early age. And people don't just grow up and just become some monsters and all that. So our psychological well-being is very critical and very important. And what you have just said now about deep breathing, about people who have lost their loved ones and whatnot, it's showing them that maybe there's life even after their beloved one has been taken over. And that maybe life also has the beginning and the end. So mental health is of critical importance.
I'm asking that question, sorry, Dr. Kumete, from a point, from a professional's point of view, like the professional himself, the doctor was working on the patient, them debriefing, because I'm thinking about this incident with the two-year-old child. And I was left wondering whether police officers actually do debrief sessions, because you don't want somebody in the system who lacks empathy.
I agree with you, and that's a very critical thing. We actually, most of the police officers, if I were to put it that way, who actually go through these traumatic events and states, they are supposed to go through debriefing. It's a must, because it affects them, and then they become hardened if they don't go through debriefing, because then they don't have empathy, they don't have everything, they just think that life just continues and whatnot. Equally, as professionals, we are taught, actually, as doctors, to actually how to manage situations, so to say. And if you can't cope yourself, you have to go through debriefing as well, or psychological counseling, So we do that, It's very critical.
Mandisa, can you link that to the topic that you have raised? And whether debriefing can help us?
Absolutely. So I'm thinking of the media as a space of, because I think we've all, if you've read anything about journalism or if you've studied journalism, the concept of the fourth estate and the media basically being the watcher of the other three arms of the state that hold up the democracy. And I'm just wondering if we need to expand on those kinds of values. And I think the hope generally is that if we keep informing the citizen will you know think about their rights and responsibilities and exercise their agency to bring about change. But I think in South Africa, I think that's been shown to be true in service delivery protests. But I think overall, the fact that we still are sitting here in 2020, talking about a two-year-old child being raped, and of course, going back to Baby Tabang in 2001, 2002, it is something that we've just become, we just have accepted it as as a fact of almost the way that we live. So I'm wondering if just the constant barrage of information is having the effect that we sometimes think it should, and I would say broadly, I don't think so. And so I'm thinking of the media as a space for debrief, and I'm thinking about specifically some, I just want to share a couple of examples. There's a journalist in the U.S. called Nicole Hannah-Jones who's running a project called the 1619 Project, which is basically to say America didn't begin on the 4th of July, 1776, with independence. Yes. It began in 1619 with the story of slavery. So she's trying to go back to say the issues we're seeing today with race are, you know, deep-seated, and I see now Oprah Winfrey has joined that project to expand it. Locally, I'm thinking of Karen Morn, and her reporting on apartheid crimes and basically focusing on the people who are impacted by those crimes. So she's somebody who's brought back the story of people like Kilango Andre, who was in custody and died in custody at the hands of the apartheid state. And she has, I think, some form of exclusivity with Newsroom Africa, where you're seeing these mini documentaries of some people's stories, which we haven't heard, of family members who disappeared or died. And she's bringing those things up. And I think it's quite important for us to think about how the media can be used as a space for us to debrief on some of the issues that are, you know, the underlying the beliefs that we have. So so basically to get to the root of the emotions we have about things.
Sims, just quickly before we move over to the doc. When we speak about this trauma and Mandisa touched on interpersonal, what about the intergenerational trauma? You know, she just touched on the apartheid era, for instance, and Karen Moon coming back and having to cover that story as well. And I don't know what it triggers for her, but certainly for me, there are triggers.
Yes, no, I imagine. I mean, Karen was actually a student here at Rhodes University, a wonderful student, obviously. And so imagining it, she's not as old as the people who directly suffered from apartheid. But you can see there are people who've got, you know, that urge to kind of like look at the past and say, well, we need to kind of like get to the root of this problem. The biggest problem, of course, is that there's a whole, let's say, the millennials, for example. I think I'm not completely wrong to say when I say that there is a certain indifference to the history of South Africa, especially as it pertains to apartheid. I mean, you've heard these things of people asking people, others to talk to their hand and, you know, please do not talk to me about that. Oh, I'm going to be traumatized if you tell me about apartheid and what this happened. Yes, and, you know, and by the way, it is not just, you know, white people or people, let's say people who are not black, you know, Black African. Mm. It is across the board. They made a lot of young people, just don't want to hear that. They say that we have got our own problems now, and, you know, and when they talk about their own problems, of course, they talk about their iPhones and these other things. And obviously, I'm generalizing here, but the truth is that there is almost what you call compassion fatigue. You know, people don't want to hear these things. But I think part of the reason, and Mandisa talked about it, we've all touched on it, that individually we need to kind of look at the individuals. Don't say that policemen are traumatized. You go to the policeman who has seen a person being shot, who has taken the details of that 2-year-old who has been raped, and then you said you are supposed to take a mandatory leave, and it's going to be this long. You're going to be on desk duty. You're going to, you're not going to have a gun, and during this time you're going to see a psychologist. You follow through, and the psychologist is supposed to actually say this person is now ready to go back to work. Yes. To go back to work, like on the beat, for example, and carry a gun and that kind of thing. I think the intergenerational trauma is not so much. I think it is friction that people, you know, older people say, you guys don't care about the history of this country. You are just interested in material things. You love these things. And these guys say, you guys, I mean, you think that that's the only history that, you know, that we're also creating history now. And I think there is a way. And as Mandy has said, we definitely need to kind of like have that agency where we can, you know, the history that we have of the history that we have and the history that we are making are both relevant. Yeah. And I think it is possible for them, for both of them to be relevant.
Okay. Dr. Kumete, just quickly, there's a tweet here from Tikilo, and then we'll go to your conversation as well. Can trauma be destroyed like energy? Like energy, it can only be transferred from one person to the next.
Yeah, okay. That's a very good actual analogy. It's a scientific analogy, actually. Yeah. It can. Trauma can be destroyed. But then you remember what we're talking about. You have to go to the root. You cannot just say, I always say to people, during 1994, blacks were given Unos, if you remember the Uno cars, and then white people were given Bentleys. They said, let's race to Cape Town, and then whoever gets there wins, you know. I mean, we must go back to the history and check, you know, was that a fair race or not? So even emotionally, you also need to go back and say, okay, what are the tools that you have for you to travel to Cape Town? Are they adequate? Are they going to get you there on time and all that? The problem that we have, like my colleague Tim said, you know, you have people who are the Generation 2000 who says they don't care about apartheid. They should care because it has got remnants. If you look at the 1994, the Sunset Clause, it's still affecting us now.
Yes,
and I mean, and I mean, you can't say we must overlook that. You must go back to, even emotionally, now I'm intertwining them. Emotionally, you have to go to the root of the problem for you to solve it. So meaning, if I'm answering that question that was just tweeted, yes, you can, but then you need to have expertise, people who are able to go through with you through the trauma until you are on the other side. Because on your own, you can't do it. You have got people who behave like they are steering. They know how. Starting, you know how to do it. You can't. You need someone who's professionally trained to help you, guide you through the trauma, and then you become a better person.
Okay. Dr. Kumete, let's introduce your topic just after Power News headlines. It's about to turn 10:30 for Power News headlines. I just quickly want to read the story that just came through now. It's a tweet from the Premier of Gauteng, David Makura. Today, Friday the 10th of July, 2020, I received my test results confirming that I have tested positive for COVID-19. I'm now in self-isolation in line with the WHO protocols and will work from home over the next 14 days whilst monitoring my health. This is now the third Premier in the country who has tested positive for COVID-19. You remember Alan Windey in the Western Cape, as well as Premier Job in the Northwest. It's 10:30, time for Power News headlines.
Aldrin Sampier, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
And we're in conversation with Mandi Sampolo as well as Sim Chazi. We also have Dr. Donald Gumete. We're taking your calls on 0861-987-000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Sampier, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. Dr. Gumete, your topic?
Yes. Yeah. And first and foremost, thank you. And I wish the Premier a speedy recovery. The information is coming out now. When we started with COVID, we had around 8 strains. Which were identified. Now we are sitting at 23 strains.
Wow.
And and amongst that, the confusion, like the topic that I'm going to be discussing today, is the fact that you have one or two members in a family, close family, who are positive and the rest are negative. And now WHO, like the Premier has written there, we rely on them. But then, there is also a lot of dispute there with scientists because the mode of transmission, it was said it was droplets and surface contact surface. Now, you see, it has been suggested that it's airborne, that it can stay in the air and be transported by airways and get into you and whatnot. Now, we have got serious confusion, to be honest with you, because look at it this way. You are in close contact. You are 7 at home, only 2 people test positive, and you are not wearing masks. Think about it. And we are saying you must wear masks to protect yourself. And I've got lots of patients who are like that, to be honest with you. And in these 23 strains, what we have realized is there is those which are, I would call it weak, so that people must understand, and those which are medium and those which are strong. We can take from your Nando's where there's mild and hot and extra hot. If you want to call it that way.
And lemon and herb.
I hope they don't steal my caption. as such, you see, we have majority of people who have got the mild strain, who actually don't even have signs and symptoms to the virus. Yeah, They just test positive, and then that's it. And I must emphasize that people have not actually been explained properly that the virus gets active according to the understanding that we have now for 14 days. So if you tested outside that period of 14 days, you'll test negative, you see, because we are looking for the PCR, meaning we're looking for the virus. And if it's not there, you're going to test negative. So now we must go to the next phase, which is your antibodies, which actually is the topic of today. Because now the problem we have with the antibodies is that they say they disappear in the system. So meaning if, Adrian, you got infected, we checked you were positive. We take you 2-3 weeks down the line, even the antibodies are no more there anymore. So it's like you have never been infected or you never had the coronavirus. So it's a conundrum that actually is still developing and in the society. So there are 239 scientists who went there to confront the World Health Organization to say, guys, but I think there are things that we're missing here and we are not being addressed and we are just being pushed forward to say we must accept things which actually don't make sense. So in short, what has happened now, we've got many families, like I'm saying, who are we have one or two people. And imagine some of them are intimate partners here. We're talking about husband and wife. When you find that the wife is positive, the husband is negative, or vice versa. You see? Or you find that now it means the mode of transmission, we have not fully understood it or comprehended it, to say the least.
And I think that's... Difficult, Mandisa, when some people hear about, for instance, a partner who is positive, but the other one is negative. Like, how did that happen? Like, for instance, we can go back to the example of the two-year-old. The two-year-old was suspected of having COVID, but the mother not.
Well, I think just generally, I'm concerned just that it's what the attitudes that we have towards the virus. I can see a lot of people are saying they are lonely and they are missing their companions and they want to have visits. And all this kind of thing. So when we, so these kinds of cases are confusing for people who want to basically override the restrictions and go ahead and have these intimate partner relationships. It's strange. I don't know what more to say about it. It just makes it difficult as a citizen to navigate to navigate the virus.
And Sim.
Yeah, no, Mandy is absolutely right. It's difficult to do it. I mean, people are talking about being lonely. I mean, you're going to start seeing, I'm hoping I'm wrong, obviously, but you're going to start seeing a surge now. People are talking about surges, a surge in numbers of people going to Fort England and these other, mental health hospitals. And, because it is just unnatural for people to be walled up in places unless they're prisoners. If you're a prisoner, you have a debt to pay, But we are actually like in an open-air prison. And in fact, people, I've seen some research from the Gaza Strip in the Middle East, where the Palestinians live. About 1.7 million people live in a very, very, very small place. And they call it the largest open-air prison. And they say that the largest concentration of depressed people is in that place, in the Gaza Strip. Now, I think this is going to spread across the entire world because it is just impossible to live in close quarters like we are doing now. Even if you don't have COVID-19, I mean, to be cooped up with even loved ones, I mean, you get fed up of them and they get fed up of you, obviously. And often, I'm surprised we don't have as many cases of domestic killings as you would expect. I'm not trying to trivialize this issue, Audrey. But the truth is that I think that this is powder keg waiting to explode.
I wanted to ask you then, do you think that what Dr. Kumete just said now about the information that is coming through, for instance, now we're speaking about 23 different strains and the 239 scientists that had to write to the WHO, than yeah,
which
for
one
journalists.
Was that? I didn't catch the last bit.
The 239 scientists who wrote to the WHO about COVID-19 also being airborne. That with the reportage of it, it becomes more difficult to report on it, because one day we are reporting this and then the next day there's something new. And I wonder whether it causes confusion for consumers of news as well.
Absolutely. No, there's no doubt about that, Aldrin and colleagues. There is no doubt about that. And these guys, the people who are actually disagreeing with the WHO, are not fly by the night. They're not Sangoma. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. I'm really so sorry.
Yes, I shouldn't have said that.
Please forgive me. They're not charlatans. That's what I meant, really. You know, I was just using the word. I'm really, really sorry. Anyway, the point is that they are not charlatans. These are Nobel laureates in science and medicine. They are serious people, professors of epidemiology and medicine in around the world, and they are saying that this thing is airborne. Now, for us as journalists, you can't say, oh well, I'll choose this or the other. I think now, for me, my own sense is that really we should be erring on the side of people who are saying that this thing is more serious than we think, because then at least you don't lose all your deposit. You know, that's my own view. That's what I thought.
Can I come in there? I actually think also there's too much media sensation, to be honest with you. Because look at America. They're sitting at 134 deaths, right? But they're not digging 1 million graves, you see. We are sitting at 3,700 graves. We are already digging graves. And you see, I think also the mindset of the society. I like Marcus Aurelius. During the Antonian in the 165 after the death of Christ, he actually went around and reassured people. Though they lost 5 million of people during that plague, but then he was the pillar of strength to bring wisdom and understanding of the situation. The problem with us, we are sensationalists. We like to sensationalize. And I mean, let me just give you figures so that you understand, appreciate the whole thing. We have got 85,000 beds in the whole country, okay, in the public hospitals, servicing how many millions people? 60 million. So private and public, it's 120 beds combined. Think about it. Baragwanath, your Christiani hospital, has got 3,600 beds, serving Soweto, which has got almost 4 million population. Is it possible? You look at Joburg again, it has got around 1,088 beds. These beds are few. And I mean, you cannot accommodate everybody. But the problem is this, which causes the clock in the system. It's because of the panic and the fear that most of the people who have COVID-19, they will recover from home. They don't need to go to hospitalization. But the media has said to them that there are ventilators, 10,000. Imagine, even if we've got 10,000 ventilators, in the population that we have a huge population. So the problem is, like I'm saying, we also in the media, we must hold media accountable on whether what they're reporting at times. Is it to scare people, or is it to affirm people, or is it to educate people? Because that's very critical.
Point taken. Tikelo, good morning.
Aldrin, how are you?
Good, how's it?
I am okay. Two questions quick to the doctor. Isn't the approach taken by South Africa with the whole information coming out now a bit wrong? And I'm saying that because like you said, there's low risk, there's medium risk, there's a high risk. Mm. Shouldn't we be working towards taking people from high risk to medium or low? Because it is obvious, it's becoming obvious that most of us are going to get a COVID at some point. The second question, people that recover on their own without even knowing that they once had corona, can they go test to see that they once had it? Are there markers in them?
Okay, Dr. Kumete?
Yeah, all right. Yeah, very good questions. Actually, what the caller said is precisely very good, to be honest with you. Because you see, with our under-resourced healthcare system, we should have had a command center which actually has got expertise and knowledge to say how do we as a country deal with corona? I don't know if I'm making sense. Meaning, concentrating on what is necessary. You get what I'm trying to say? Because majority of the people will get this coronavirus and they won't even know, to be honest. And and that I will answer in the second question. Now, the high risk people is those that we had said elderly, comorbidity. You get what I'm trying to say? Those are the people that we have to be looking after because they're susceptible and they're more likely to die. So we should actually, with our limited resource, concentrate on such people to say, okay, these are the people who actually maybe were supposed to be quarantined or supposed to be not be in contact and whatnot. But again, I must emphasize that also it depends on your immune system, meaning your soldiers in the system to fight the virus, you see. Because there are people who...
Dr. Kometa, I'm going to push you to quickly answer the second question so that we can move over to Sim's conversation.
The second question is, yes, there are markers to check whether you came into contact with the virus or not. We call them antibodies.
But you said the antibodies then disappear in some people.
But again, that's what I've just said. That again, we've got this conundrum whereby they disappear. So, meaning, if I were to answer it holistically, you may and may not get them.
That's a very difficult one. Okay, Sim, let's go to your conversation.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Aldrin. Well, I was talking about, already my topic was essentially around the issue of unemployment in South Africa, because South Africa, like a lot of middle-income countries, not a lot, actually, maybe, you know, South Africa, unlike a lot of middle-income countries, it's not, it's very urbanized, but it's got a lot of unemployment because it depends so much on the agricultural sector. I think we have not delinked the rural areas from urban areas in terms of employment. That there are just so many people, obviously, who are unemployed. Now, my own sense is that we have, as a country, we have really not resolved this issue. And I think that one of the biggest problems is around these. Let's talk about SOEs, for example. What are they? The state-owned enterprises. I mean, we have about 800 of them, right? You know, they say that the government employs about 2.5 million people. But if you compare that to the 60 million people who live in this country, you know, that is really a drop in the ocean, isn't it? It's not it's not a lot of people are actually employed. And I will tell you honestly, we all know that a lot, there's probably a majority of the people in this 2.5 actually underemployed, in a sense. So if you add on to the 27% to 40% of other South Africans who are either unemployed or stopped looking for jobs, we really have a real problem of unemployment in this country. And if you combine...
But why do you then say don't link it to SOEs?
No. The reason I was going to link it to SOEs, I was trying to say that there is this, you know, I think it's a myth that, you know, state-owned enterprises are going to create jobs. I mean, look at South African Airways, for example. I mean, this company has, or SOE, has been, you know, it has been on drip for the last 20 years, and it has been a problem for the country since, I think, the end of apartheid, in a sense, you know. It has had so many, such a turnover of CEOs and treasurers and this kind of thing. But it is a problem. And the reason why it's a problem is very simple, you know, really, that South African Airways has got its own structural problems, but it's also competing in the real world for real people, you know what I mean? And yet, the biggest customer for SOE should actually be government of South Africa. In fact, I think that the people who travel most in this country are government officials at all levels, local, regional, and national level, whether they are going from town to town.
Shouldn't we de-link mismanagement of SOEs with employment and the purpose that SOEs serve, not only being able to do business on behalf of the state, but also in that the work that SOEs do in the transformation of the country? Because when you look at the employment equity report that comes out every year, you'd find that a high concentration of white managers you'd find in the private sector, and then a high concentration of black managers you'd find in the public sector, including SOEs.
Yes. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. That is, we actually should actually de-link those two. That it's not because the things that it's not because the people in the private sector are white and the people in the government sector are black. The thing is that let us, if you want to compare them, let us look at return of value. You know, what is the return of value for these two groups?
Yeah.
That the private sector, they would say that, oh, well, I've made so many ventilators, for example. And this person would say, oh, well, I've, mismanaged so much money over the last period. You know, this is what I mean. I think the problem is that there is no consequence for bad behavior, I think, in the SOEs. There's no consequence for that. That is what we need to resolve, you know.
But look, can I object a bit to what Tim says? Because they are not 100% correct. Yeah. You see, if you go back, let's go back again, like I explained, go back to the apartheid era, you know. And there's a very nice document which is written thoroughly how the SOEs were started during the apartheid. And where it tended to actually favor the white Afrikaners, you know, they were employed in key positions to make sure that they earn more money so that they alleviate poverty during the defeat by the British in South Africa, the Anglo-Boer War. Yes. Now the problem is, if you realize the problem at the SOEs majority of time is that the government doesn't buy into support, because you cannot go into any country and you have your local airline being competed by a foreign airline. It doesn't make sense. Because we should actually, SAA should be dominating locally so that we support SAA, and then the money circulates here at home. And then that way we'll create more employment, because why? They will need more carriers. And whatnot. We don't have that. We have got an open door market. Go to the US. When you land there, you cannot find a British airway or a South African airway locally taking you around to interstate. So it's critical that actually we must look at the issue holistically. Not only in a small. It's exactly with Eskom. It's the same problem we have with Eskom. You see, we have people who actually run Eskom. Who are actually not even government officials there. I won't mention them because I don't want to be sued, but you know them.
Yes, of course. No, I agree with you, Dr. Gomede. I think I misrepresented myself. I was trying to say that I agree entirely that we need to look at this thing holistically. The problem is that we are deploying, I think government deploys expertise, you know, haphazardly in these SOEs. And as a result of that, they don't work optimally. That one of the things that should be pushed, you know, as policymakers, I think we should, maybe one of the SOEs we should have is a think tank for government, the one which comes up with policy. And one of the things should be that, Dr. Gomede, I agree with you entirely, that it should be that how do we get the most number of people across the entire value chain employed in this country? And one of them should be protecting these people from protecting our SOEs from competition to a certain extent. China has not grown because it is not it is just the big, largest producer of things. It is also protecting its SOEs.
Its own industries.
Can I jump in there?
Yes, of course. Yes.
There's a wonderful piece on Daily Maverick that Mwele Zimbeki wrote about basically the nature of the SOEs, where he's talking about it's critical to understand the difference between Afrikaner and African elites. So he's basically saying you have to understand how the... So basically he's responding to Uzweli Zimavavi's suggestion that South Africa now must learn from how the Afrikaner state lifted itself up. And so some of the points that Mwele Zimbeki is making is that basically the Afrikaner state So the African state basically rose out of exploitation of black people. Mm. And that the SOEs were basically used as sheltered employment to solve the poor white problem in the 1920s, 1930s, if my history is correct. And so the issue, what he's saying, raising, is that this worked for the Afrikaners because they were landowners, and so they used the state basically to achieve the, to basically provide services that they needed as landowners to grow their businesses. And so this was the approach to using the SOEs, and then they were able to, because they were generating money from the enterprises, able to then have this sheltered employment for the poor whites. Mm-hmm. The situation, I think, in South Africa, we need to take a step back to ask ourselves basically the strategy of how the state is using these SOEs. Effectively, you could have sheltered employment, in my view, but you would have to actually have a productive relationship with these SOEs. And the strategy of basically capturing the synergies between what these different SOEs are designed to do, that is, for me, the failure of where we are.
And getting the right people into the jobs.
Exactly, because the second part of it is saying you have the, well, the Afrikaner state also had people who were not educated and skilled and had to get into these jobs as a sheltering. So what I'm saying is, even if you had that design, we, with South Africa and its unemployment problems and the lack of educational attainment, you could be using the state in this way. But the problem would be, for me, the problem that is emerging now is, if you read the Auditor General's report, one of the main things he raises is basically hiring consultants to do double work when you actually have, for instance, a finance function that doesn't produce financial statements. But now we're paying hundreds of millions to the, you can name any audit firm, the big four audit firms, to come in and solve that problem. One of the ways National Treasury has worked on it is to start a project, I think, that with SAICA, where they're trying to professionalize the public service, to get accountants to come in and train government staff.
With that said, thank you so much, Mandi Sambulo, as well as Sim Chazi and Dr. Donald Gumede. This feature was brought to you by SAICA, the premier accounting institute that develops highly competent accountancy professionals from a functional to a strategic level of financial management. It's 11 o'clock, time for Power News.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.